Welcome to Accept Your Gifts, the 22-minute podcast for inspiring your most creative life. My name is Tracy Crow. I'm an author, writing coach, and Marine Corps veteran. I'm looking forward to co-creating today's show with you. So if you're ready, are you ready? I'm ready. So if you're ready to live a more creative, more magical life, let's get started. Thank you for returning for part two of my special series with guest Michael Lancaster. If you recall, Mike is a West Point graduate, class of 1967, and he flew a helicopter gunship with the 101st Airborne in Vietnam. I first met Mike a couple of years ago through mutual Facebook friends, and all of us have learned to pause through our often mindless timeline scrolling whenever we come across a Michael Lancaster post. Because a post from Mike offers a much-needed poetic, meditative time out. Whether he's sharing reflections about the salt ponds outside his Virginia home, or about the wildlife inhabiting those salt ponds, Mike has a way of seeing and honoring the sacredness within it all. And when his wife of 51 years, Ellen, passed away 8 months ago, we witnessed how poetry and life on the salt ponds appear to be assisting our friend through grief and through his own life transition without Ellen. So let's pick up where we left off Tuesday with Mike, his insights about the meaningful connections with nature, and how he even constructs a poem in such a way as to honor the divinity within everything.
Let me take you back now to another dimension of me, which I think is critical. On the one hand, I'm well aware of both the content of metaphor and how I want to use it to live my life. On the other hand, my entire life, from the time I was six, I have been a deeply rooted Catholic Christian. And I really played the game. You know, I for many, many years, I prayed the monastic prayer of the hours, right from the very books. You know, that in the Catholic Church, that's something that all of the clergy have to do, especially if you're in a monastery, and all of the laity, or all the religious people, nuns and everybody, have to do that. But the laity is encouraged to do that. Well, I've also had spiritual direction over the years, and this is where I'm going to. This is crucial to who Mike Lancaster is. I was struggling with several issues about the Catholic Church, and I can't continue to do that today. I mean, you know, my fallback is, look, there it's just an institution of men and women. Why would it be any better than any other institution? And you can't demand that of them because you don't demand that of yourself. Okay, got it. And then I leave it there, and then I pick it up off the table again 2 years later and start arguing with myself. But I started taking spiritual direction, and I've done that a number of times with a number of different people, mostly with people who were friends, who were, you know, they were spiritual directors, but they were friends. Right. I played music, had a band for many years, and we went in and did prison ministry. We went in and did ministry on military bases. We did with college students and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. All of us are a little too old and too right now to, I'm not, but the other two guys in the band are. So we get together once a year for a reunion and sit around with very expensive whiskey and play music and don't sleep. It's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
I bet.
So I've had a connection inside the church all along with music. So this one spiritual director I had, he was for real, and he was a musician and a good one. And so we connected on several different levels. But we talked, and you know, we talked three or four times, and he wasn't saying, well, we can do this or not. You know, and frankly, he confessed to me later. He said, I wasn't too sure I wanted to take you on as a trip. I'm never sure when you come to church what parking lot you're going to park in. You know, he said, your intellect's all over the place. And and I said, well, it's not all over the place. I'm just democratic. And, you know, and to me, knowledge is knowledge. And ideas are good because they're good, not because of somebody who said it.
Right.
And yeah, he said, yeah, I get that. But he said, you have to remember that the church is not a democratic institution. And sometimes, sometimes you have to back off and just follow because they said, I said, no, never. Never will I give that authority to the church. Mm. Never. I said, when I get to heaven, St. Peter's going to look me in the eye, and I am not going to be able to use the defense that the church said you should do that.
Right. Wow. But,
you know, and you know, and then he finally, and he said, let's do it. So we had a couple sessions where we talked about this is how we're going to proceed. And he said, I'm going to do the Carmelite method. He said, I'm a Carmelite director. That's St. Teresa of Avila, one of the doctors of the church.
Right.
And John of the Cross, one of the brilliant poets of the church and mystics, was a Carmelite. And he said, I'm going to use their method, and you're going to read their books. And he said, one of the first things we're going to do is I'm going to give you a spiritual virtue, which I want you to adopt as your central core idea. I said, oh God, here it comes. and he turned and he said, your virtue is humility.
Okay.
You kidding me? I said, I am not a humble man. I'm not. And to try to make me one is going to be like trying to turn me into a Buick Roadmaster. It doesn't work.
What was his response?
And he said, no. He said, you don't understand what humility is. And I said, okay, tell me. And he said, it has two or three parts. All three are very important. And this, the next words he spoke to me were the most life-changing words I have ever heard.
Mm. Wait a minute. Let me brace for impact. Okay.
No impact.
Okay. No. All right. Go.
The first is that I want you to take all of that wonderful capability you have. I know you are a gifted person. I know you have a brilliant intellect. I know you have skills at communicating that intellect. I know you have all those things. He said, I want you to think of yourself as a thoroughbred racehorse. And I want you to go into the gate and stand there and all of your muscles shaking. And you're waiting for that one very quiet word that comes from the master that says, run. And I want you to run like the wind when you hear those words. Okay, I got it. So he said, that's who you're for. Nobody else. In the end, that's who you're for. And you will hear that word. You will hear that word. And I heard that word several times.
Oh, wow.
And the second thing is humility. He said, if you want to break down humility, way of looking at what I just told you. He said, let's take a concrete example from your life. When you love your wife, broadly speaking, and here's where people go wrong. When you sit and talk to your spouse, to your wife, or she's talking to you, you empty yourself completely. All of your concerns, all of the poems you're writing, all of this and that and the other thing that's occupying your space right now, and you empty that all out. Just like the tides in the salt ponds, empty it all out for life to come in. and you sit there and you focus on that woman and you let that woman fill you like water coming in the channels. And we practice that at a critical time. In the quiet, in the silence, on the snow. And so when you consider nature, and this is what I do every day, at least twice a day, sometimes more than that. And I can sit right here at the computer and I can turn my head just like this and I can see the expanse of the salt ponds.
Okay, wait, let me stop you. Describe for listeners who are not familiar with salt ponds, what are they? What are you seeing?
I sit here, and they're all up and down the Chesapeake and in the area. And actually they go down through the low countries into the Carolinas. And basically what they are wetlands, tidal wetlands. And in this case, it's a special one called the Chesapeake wetlands. And it's seagrasses on mud, and the mud hummocks in there that have been carved by tides over the years, maybe as much as 16 feet tall. If you empty all the water, 16 feet of mud. Wow. And then 4 feet of grass on top.
Okay.
And then you have these little pockets of trees around that give definition, but I got to move my foot here. So you're beginning to metaphor and religion come together in a model which I've kind of built for myself, where everything I do, everything I touch, everything I love, I empty myself for. And in a way, the salt ponds has become an extension of divinity for me. Okay, and so and this is what Wendell was getting at. In his poems about the Sabbath, he said, "I work my farm for 6 days, and I walk through the stile, and I walk into the woods, and I walk into God's farm, and I lay down, and I rest." I rest in his growth. And I can't tell you how much that little damn book meant to me.
I can see. Yes. I must own a copy right away.
8-10 years of the Sabbath poems that he did.
Enough to hear one of your poems at this point?
Yeah. Yeah. Let me, I'm going to cheat. You said two poems. I'm going to cheat because of other poems I wrote. One of them had a great background to it because it was a learning experience. It was poetry for me, but it was an explaining experience to other people what poetry was. The learning experience for me was I had taught for years that poets don't sit down in the middle of the night. I mean, Coleridge didn't sit there in an opium spell by candlelight and firelight and scratch off Kublai Khan. It didn't happen.
Right. I
mean, these are carefully written, thought out poems. Okay. Fast forward to Lancaster sitting on the deck with one of his buddies from work. And he kind of looked at me across the table and said, "Well, how do you write a poem? What's a poem?" And I said, "It's a way of seeing something in a new way." And the use of metaphor in there is to add a dimension of awareness to a simple description that makes it mean something.
Right.
So just as a quick example, this is the first poem I wrote. So we're sitting there and he says, "Well, write me a poem." I said, "Well, what do you see here?" He said, "I see a bunch of grasses and stuff out there. Is there anything else you see?" "Oh yeah, there's a house over there on a bit of water." "What else do you see? What do you see in the yard?" And he said, "Well, it looks like there's a clothesline there and there's some clothes hanging on it. And there's an old shed and there's a dog wandering around." I said, "Okay, let's turn that into a poem." That simple description of life, I mean, just imagine the simple aspect of life of clothes hanging on a clothesline.
Right.
Let's make that sacred. Let's say it's Pentecost, and this is a salt ponds Pentecost. And I wrote, and we sat there, and I wrote, and he watched me do it, and I have not changed a word in that poem since. A single sentence of 14 lines. Mm. Kingfishers muttering furiously, bordering the life of a family known in a clothesline of 6 pairs of jeans pinned upon a lifeline of wire stretched from a weathered shed to a post. anchoring its occasional fabric burdens, as well as a line of tomato plants scrambling into amid the clarion wake-up call of red-winged blackbirds, providing descant and the promise of indolent summer.
Oh.
And so all of a sudden, that simple awareness becomes, when you bring in that metaphor of Pentecost and the kingfishers singing and the red-winged blackbirds and remember, Pentecost was all about words, languages that spoke to everyone. It was about noise. I mean, I have played music with many charismatic groups whose prayer was the glossalia. Just, you turn your vocal cords over to the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. I've done that. That is amazing. And so I've never changed a word of that poem. And so I said to myself, maybe I was really wrong about Coleridge.
Well, really maybe. Wrong. I doubt it, but maybe.
I'll read you in a minute a piece of a poem which is getting published by William and Mary soon, the end of which is going to be the kind of a preamble to my book. And then I want the other poem I really want to read you is the poem that I've told everybody is my last poem.
Oh.
And everybody went crazy and they said, what? You can't stop writing poems. Well, I said, this is my last poem. This is everything I want me and my poetry and my life to be. So wherever I am, whenever I pass, this poem is going to be published in my last book or wherever you all want to put it. But this is my last poem. So I'll read those to you eventually here whenever you're ready. I very immediately saw the divinity of the salt ponds. And there is a, you know, the Holy Spirit in the Christian tradition of Trinity is the power that continues and magnifies life, all for the praise of the Father. And the Trinity is to me, is as simple as pie. It's very easy. I don't have a problem with it. Everybody has a problem with it because they say, I can't have three gods and one God. Stop. Don't even go there. The Father is the impulse. He spoke the word, let there be. And Jesus is the word. He made everything. And then he humbled himself. And I had one of the most magnificent meditations one night. Scared the shit out of me. But I actually saw all of that happen in an instant. There's something about the intensity of noise that causes you to leave your senses. It's happened to me at least twice. Once it was under severe rocket bombardment in Vietnam when they were trying to blow up all of our helicopters.
Mm.
And they got a few. The noise is so intense, you can't even move out of the way. You just sort of lay down.
Right. Mike, let me go someplace with you before we get close to wrapping up here. For those who know you personally, even those of us who know you through the magic of Facebook or social media channels, we know that the last few years for you have been quite a personal struggle because your beloved wife, Ellen, was ill and you lost her back in June. And I don't know if you know this little story, I don't think I shared this with you, but there was, maybe because my middle name is Ellen, there was something that, some sort of connection I always felt to her and to the two of you.
Yeah.
In June, the night she passed, I happened to be in Austin spending the night with my daughter. I had a workshop to teach in San Antonio the next morning. And for some reason, around 3:30 in the morning, I woke up with the most beautiful music playing in my head. You know, it was this music that I sometimes play when I'm teaching a writing workshop and I'm taking my students through a shamanic writing exercise. And for some reason that had become like this earwig at 3:30 in the morning playing in my head. So I went ahead since I was awake and I turned on my phone and I found that music. But while I was listening to that song that was obviously waking me up anyway, I happened onto Facebook. And I saw your post that Ellen had just passed away.
Yeah.
And it hit me so hard. I felt somehow personally connected to both of you as if this was something that had awakened me in the middle of the night and with this beautiful music and of her beautiful spirit. But what I noticed about you all these past several months is whatever you were going through, you never lost touch with nature, the beauty of it, the gratitude for it, your creativity. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about that and how that was possible.
Well, you know, obviously I'm still putting that together in my head. Ellen and I celebrated our 51st anniversary 3 days before she passed. She was other than the deity himself or herself or whatever itself, I hope. She was the creating genius in my life. She was a teacher. She was the discipline. She allowed me to be in it to be. She just took care of the details. And that made my military career better than it might have been. She was a brilliant, brilliant parent. And she taught me how to be a parent and how to love my kids and let them grow. And in many ways, we were as close as we were when we were kids. I have a picture of us when I was a sophomore at West Point. And she looks like a 12-year-old. She always did look young, but we're sitting there, you know, at the lake at Camp Buckner, and there are other people around, but we'd been sitting there singing music, you know. I had a guitar with me, and we were just, that was always our relationship. And so she said, we have to be kind to each other, and that was when we were really, really kind to each other and thoughtful. And then, you know, the longer you're married, the harder that becomes sometimes. And some people never quite get over it. In my case, the love always overcame that. I have an easygoing dimension with life. I don't get terribly excited about things. I grew up on a farm. Not my farm. My dad was a barber, had a barber shop in town, but all of the male cousins, my mom had six sisters, so I had seven mothers. Oh, and I say that with great delight. I have known strong women from the time I was an infant to today, and they have been a delicious part of my life, and you know, and Ellen was an oak tree. And so to me, the hard part was watching her deteriorate, go through chemotherapy. She was in a medical test. So the chemotherapy was a double dose. It almost killed her twice. She was in ICU twice for 7-8 days while they tried to get the poison out of her, and eventually they took her off the test and stopped chemotherapy because they said, you know, that look, the tumors have shrunk almost percent now from this. We can stop this now. And so I said, we're going to wait until you're strong enough to have surgery. We're going to go in and take everything out. And Ellen has been through surgery after surgery after surgery over the years, going back to the time 80. So I just, every time she did that, I just curled up inside. But I had curled up enough inside enough to know that this was all happening and, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. So like every other thing in life that has gone, you simply have to ride the horse you've been given. And to be strong, I mean, this goes back to the farm. I mean, animals live and animals die. And cousins live and cousins die. And parents live and parents die. And uncles live and uncles die. And it's just a part of life. And in my heart, I know that there are passageways for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Ellen, then they, after the surgery didn't work, then they offered her and she took it for a bit, experimental immunotherapy. And I've written a poem about all of this. It's called Taking Ellen to Chemotherapy. There again is a metaphor. A metaphor is light. And the hospital is gray and dingy and the doors don't really work and the wheelchairs are squeaky. And you take her in, and as you walk down the hallway to where she gets her therapy, there's light there. And the light doesn't come from the institutional light, which is as dingy as the damn building. But beautiful nurses. You can break me down.
Sorry. I know I'm getting emotional too.
No, I need to say this. I need to say it because it's the beauty. It's the beauty of Ellen and her passing. I notice things and they have significance to me. And all of that gets wrapped up in this wonderful prayer. I'm emptying myself. The salt ponds is emptying its tides. And there you have this brilliant mud that is new life.
Wow. Michael, will you read us that other poem?
I will. This is my last poem. And the last five or six lines of the poem have been made into a ballet by a professional troupe in Philadelphia. They performed it a number of times. And this poem is called Heading Old. And I'm 73 now. I'll be 74 in a couple of months. And I can feel the changes. I'm dealing with them, I think, pretty well. And this is the poem. It's called Heading Old. And I want it to be my last, published as my last poem, because it says everything I want to say. Years now on salt ponds, poems tracking generations long past, generations deeply forward, life after life, arriving, being, passing to life matter, mud, water, new life, grasses, birds, fish uncountable, crustacean fish, immortality. In consciousness, I too am circular life, limning its cadences, urgent as life, even as my cadence slows from its primal assertion to be my father. Miming his pace, I sought his side, then strode strongly past, completing his dreams, now immortal in me. In time, my children and theirs stream my immortality in their urgency. My cadence now slows to bird life, soft, spare, vulnerable to all, mine to teach me the exquisite truth, who companion my slower life on a fall day in great pale sun, lovely mute colors, breezes turning my hair to winter white, warm yet in memory, and grace, vision, astride 1 foot firm in this wonderful place, 1 foot testing new ground that feels more like home.
Oh. Mike, thank you.
You bet.
For having accepted your gifts, and especially for sharing them with all of us. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Yep, you're welcome. You're most welcome.
I hope you enjoyed today's co-creative listening experience. Please remember to leave a comment about the single greatest takeaway for you today. You know, that one thing you will remember from this day forward. Was it something funny or provocative? Was it just what you needed to hear? Please share so we can all benefit. And remember to return Tuesdays and Thursdays to Accept Your Gifts, the 22-minute podcast for inspiring your most creative life.